Chief Justice Havokin is recused and Justice Stefan will not be participating. Chief Judge Moore of the Court of Appeals and Judge Inbody will be sitting in their place. If you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court and Counsel. My name is Pat Carney. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Eric Vela. And this is an appeal for a denial of an evidentiary hearing from a post-conviction request. This is going back to LB1, and the Court has dealt with this on several occasions, but I think this is a little bit of a different situation than what the Court has seen. The allegation in the post-conviction is that Mr. Vela wanted to enter a plea of guilty. Counsel advised or coerced him not to do that, to hang on. There was a series of motions, a series of challenges in this death penalty case. And what I would indicate to this Court is, when LB1 came in, the case was filed prior to LB1. It was in the district court when LB1 was passed, prior to any entry of a plea. And that was November 22nd of 2002. The notice of aggravation, which was required in LB1, was not filed, in this case, until January 29th. During that time period, he could have entered a plea to the then existing information on file, which did not contain the notice of aggravators. In LB1, it was very clear, if there's no notice of aggravators, then the penalty is life. Death penalty is off the table. And so what I think an evidentiary hearing would have shown in this case is his willingness and desire to enter that plea. Counsel talked him out of it, whatever happened there, but the evidence would have shown his willingness to enter a plea. Had he done so at a time when there was no notice of aggravation, there would not have been a death penalty.
Why isn't this argument foreclosed by our opinion in State versus Galindo?
Galindo, Galindo was different. Galindo was a trial setting. The notice was filed on Galindo prior to him appearing in Galindo. The notice was filed the same day, November 22nd. There was an amended information giving the notice of aggravation. But only that applies. It's not the same case. When you go back and look at the transcript here, the amended information with the notice of aggravation was not filed until January 29th. So I think you've got a major distinction between the two cases.
Are you saying that prior to the adoption of LB1, there was no death penalty possibilities for first-degree murder?
No. No, I don't think Ring changed that. I think that this Court's made that clear that there was a death penalty, the means by which to carry it out needed to be reviewed. But we're not arguing that there was not a death penalty.
So if he pled to first-degree murder prior to the adoption of LB1, why wouldn't he have been eligible for the death penalty?
He may have been eligible for the death penalty.
Even in the absence of a notice of aggravators.
I don't think it was required.
At that point in time.
Correct.
So what's ineffective about urging him to wait as opposed to urging him to plead guilty prior to the adoption of LB1? What's the prejudice if he was still subject to a death penalty prior to LB1?
I think in that situation, had he pled prior to LB1, I think when LB1 came out, it was still, the sentence hadn't been handed down yet, and I think he would have been entitled, I'm guessing, but he would have been entitled to either withdraw his plea and request that the notice of aggravation be filed so he knows which aggravators that he was contending with, or go back and proceed with the aggravation trial then. I think that, in State v. Yuma, that was kind of discussed after the Padilla decision.
But he had an aggravation trial, and he had and information that alleged the aggravators.
Not until well after LB1.
As you read LB1 and the relevant law, is this correct? At what point does the requirement for an aggravator become effective and its absence precludes the death penalty?
LB1 was effective immediately, November 22nd. We were...
And it would apply to previously filed informations.
I think it would. I think this court in Gales and Mata was looking at the pretrial and trial steps being completed, and that obviously wasn't the case here. We just had an information that was filed. You're in district court. LB1 comes along, is effective immediately, and it's very clear in LB1 if there's no notice of aggravation given.
And you're saying it applied to those informations filed prior to its effective date. Is that necessary to your argument?
Yes, for that stage of this particular case, it was. And when you go back and you look at Gales was completed. There was the trial stage and the sentencing stage, and then this comes along. So I think you've got a different factual setup.
Because you're focusing on roughly 3 months during which Mr. Vela was subject to an information which did not have notice of aggravator. Is that?
That's correct.
That's the period during which you're focusing.
That's correct. And that's the argument, that's the distinction between this case and the other cases that this court has looked at and decided. And I would propose, as a defense attorney, when you look at a case of this nature and this magnitude, you know there's not evidence out there of what occurred. I think it becomes incumbent upon you then to minimize the damage. This isn't about guilt or innocence. It's minimizing the damage. And the damage here is life or death.
What your argument is, because it's kind of difficult to understand if you've pled to first-degree murder prior to LB1, which required notice of aggravators, and in that case you wouldn't have a notice of aggravation, and you could be sentenced to death just based upon what the panel decides, right? Now, after LB1, you're given notice of aggravator, so you can prepare a defense.
As to what you're going to use, what the state's going to use for imposition of the death penalty. How are you prejudiced by the adoption of LB1 and not pleading prior to its adoption?
I think it looks at an ineffective assistance argument.
Well, what's ineffective? You're actually getting more rights than you had before, aren't you?
The law has changed, and that change in the law affects
you. But do you think the legislature, by passing LB1, intended to void the death penalty for any of those persons who had pled guilty prior to its adoption? And obviously weren't charged in the information with aggravators?
Well, the death penalty was applicable to all at that point. I mean, that's not the argument that I'm making. Right. What is different here, though, is focusing on life or death of your client. And you've got local counsel that was appointed, then you have the commission.
But your argument is if he'd pled before the adoption of LB1, he couldn't be sentenced to death.
No, that's not the argument. The argument is he would have pled after LB1. He had appearances in court that would have allowed him to plead to an information that did not have any notice of aggravation attached to it. Had he done that, there would not have been the possibility of the death penalty, because LB1 clearly spelled that out. So that's where the argument goes on this. That's the main thing.
Would
here.
The state, after the adoption of LB1, be authorized to amend its information to charge the aggravator?
Sure. Yes, and for whatever reason.
But your Your statement is, if I can get that plea in there before the state amends its information after the passage of LB1, then I'm not death eligible.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And that's what I think distinguishes this case from the other cases this court has looked at. The timing wasn't the same. This case is different in that respect. A very short time.
I beg your pardon, and in your view, that's a question of law that needs to precede the analysis, correct? That for those 3 months, you were not death eligible. That's a question of law.
I don't think he was death eligible.
Because the state didn't amend this information.
Correct. I don't think there's any
there's
way...
There's no factual dispute here. What I'm trying to focus on is that at the time the information came down, prior to LB1, he was death eligible.
Correct.
Then you're saying LB1 kicks in, and now he's not death eligible until the information is amended. That's your argument.
That's correct.
And that includes a question of law, does it not?
Yes, I'm not arguing that the prosecution was not precluded from amending. They could have amended, and they did in the other cases.
Did you allege that the state, and particularly the prosecutor, would have allowed a guilty plea to be made during this window that you're talking about without amending the information?
That was not alleged, and that's... The information
isn't
filed.
Isn't that kind of hard to make that leap?
Well, looking at it, I think the information is on file. If the defendant wants to come in and plead to the information that the prosecutor has put on file, they should be able to do that.
I guess what I'm suggesting, isn't it quite likely that had there been some sort of attempt to come in and plead that the prosecutor would have amended?
That may be.
And you haven't alleged that that's not the case?
That's correct.
And it would be very difficult to allege that that's not the case.
I don't know what the prosecutor would have done.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. James D. Smith, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the appellee of the state of Nebraska. I want to first address the argument that counsel just made, and I think the key to his argument were his words, I'm guessing. He didn't allege any facts there's no facts alleged in the post-conviction motion that the prosecutor would not have amended after LB1 was enacted if the defendant had tried to enter a guilty plea. He did not allege any facts that the court would have accepted such a guilty plea without allowing an amendment to the information. The LB1 was enacted only 2 months before the amended information was filed in this case. Anyhow, I think you can avoid all of that just by going to State v. Sanders, which says that a defense counsel is not deficient for not making novel arguments or giving novel advice. And this definitely would have been a first impression issue in which the appellant essentially seeks to tag one of the best defense attorneys in the state for ineffective assistance of counsel for not making some novel advice to let's slip it in under this little window and somehow or other we won't get the death penalty. I think the...
Well, you would agree that if he did enter that plea and the plea was accepted, he wouldn't be death penalty eligible, would he?
If he
pled guilty to that information...
I wouldn't agree
but
with
didn't
that.
Charge the aggravators after LB1 and the plea was accepted, you would say the state can go back and amend its information?
I think since it goes to the penalty phase, I think the issue would have then arisen as to whether or not the state would have been allowed to amend at that time to allege the aggravators
before sentencing. But the plea to the guilty, to the guilt is the key factor, isn't it? Not the penalty?
No,
if he pleads guilty to a charge that doesn't allege aggravators and that's accepted, wouldn't that be done?
The way LB1 is alleged, the process is that the state has to allege that a person's death penalty when you file your amended information, and the assumption then is allegation, you're not seeking it, which then if the court accepts the plea without that, then the state did not seek the death penalty, and so therefore the court would proceed with sentencing without the death penalty on the table. The problem with that entire argument is the assumption that the state wouldn't have sought to amend, that the court would have accepted the plea under those circumstances, all of which is speculation and are facts that weren't alleged in the post-conviction motion. He has to allege facts, not speculation. And also, again, I would say, we go back to novel arguments. Counsel is only efficient.
Well, that really wouldn't be a novel argument. It would be simply really good lawyering, wouldn't it?
It wouldn't be really good lawyering if your client ended up getting the death penalty because you miscalculated. So I think in a death penalty situation, what we had was counsel in this case was appointed within a matter of days, if not maybe a week or so, before LB1 went into effect. An attorney in those circumstances that says, hey, let's hurry up and see if we can get death penalty off the table would be, I would say in hindsight, seriously questioned for, first thing, not even doing a thorough investigation, which is an ultimate duty of an attorney. Other than that issue, I don't ever know on these what issues or claims the court might be looking at. All of the claims are in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't know if there's any particular claim other than the one that's been argued that the court might be focusing on.
You want to talk about the presiding juror for a moment?
The presiding juror in this case, the district court, as I recall, found that the evidence of the trial record affirmatively refuted the claim because of the juror's voir dire questions acknowledging that he could be fair and impartial, which is the ultimate standard. And then otherwise, the post-conviction motion didn't allege any facts that the juror could not be fair and impartial or was would have been disqualified. The fact that a juror or prospective juror knows someone or is even a pastor for one of the attorneys is not a disqualifying factor. So I would submit, at least the court got it correct, that post-conviction motion did not allege sufficient facts and alternatively the record affirmatively refuted the claim.
Mr. Smith, what about the testimony of Mr. Zalomke? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that name correctly. But he had an affidavit that indicated that because he did not actually have contact with the defendant, that his evaluation was not complete. And his testimony, of course, is a little bit different than that. But doesn't that raise an issue as to whether or not there's a need for an evidentiary issue?
It doesn't raise an issue. It raises an issue of speculation as to what would he have concluded. But he has to allege facts showing that counsel was deficient in giving the advice, not allowing Dr. Zalomke to finish the evaluation, and most importantly, that he would have been prejudiced, which then comes down to Dr. Zalomke would have concluded, in effect, that the defendant was mentally retarded. He doesn't allege those facts in his post-conviction motion, and Dr. Zalomke's testimony, as I recall, at the trial was to the effect that even though he didn't conclude the evaluation, he had enough other material and factors that he reached the conclusion that the defendant essentially was not retarded or had sufficient adaptive behaviors.
Didn't the district court, though, conclude they met the first prong? The defendant met the first prong of proving mental retardation, but it was the second prong about the adaptive reasoning that was not proven?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I believe that was the finding of the court at the sentencing panel, not the post-conviction judge, but the sentencing panel. Otherwise, I think that all of the experts, even the defendant's experts, were to the effect nobody really helped him. Other than the court, I think, gave him the one that, as far as the IQ or the low functioning level, but otherwise, he had a variety of experts and nobody got him there. And he doesn't allege in his post-conviction motion Dr. Zalomke would have been the one who would have carried the day for him. He just simply does speculation. If he would have been allowed he may have. Well, that's not sufficient. There's no reason to have a post-conviction evidentiary hearing if you've alleged he may have. You've got to allege the facts saying he would have, and he doesn't allege that. Only other comment I would make, if the court doesn't have any other particular claims that it wants to talk about, is the, at least on the ineffective claim for not objecting or requiring the court to instruct the jury on the aggravating sentence concerning the definition of malice. It appears what happened if the trial court gave the defendant an instruction that really imposed a higher burden on the state, in other words, to prove first-degree murder, than what the aggravating statute required. The aggravating statute required that the state prove a substantial prior history of serious assaultive or terrorizing criminal activity. The district court instructed the jury that the prosecution had to prove first-degree murder, which I would submit is a higher burden than what the statute required. So in essence, trial counsel is being blamed for, although he gets a favorable instruction, for not requiring or objecting to the court, further imposing a higher burden on the state than the law required. And I would submit the counsel is not deficient simply for not accepting the favorable instruction and then asking, in effect, for more than the law required. The district court really imposed a higher burden on the state by requiring it to prove first-degree murder. It didn't instruct the jury on all the elements properly. The jury does come in with that aggravating factor, but I would submit counsel's not deficient for not taking a one step further and asking for even a further definition on that higher burden. The court has no further questions. I know it would be unusual. You're going to look at it a lot closer on a death penalty case on denying post-conviction without an evidentiary hearing. But in this case, I think the district court was correct.
Let's give the defendant 2 minutes of rebuttal, but limit your argument to rebuttal. Don't re-argue your case. Just limit.
On the issue of Pastor Snow, again, I think the question is, was there ineffective assistance? If the evidence would have come in that Pastor Snow has a relationship with the prosecutor, they're spending at least an hour a week together in this type of a relationship. That question never came up. It was a simple question that could have been asked, that should have been asked, of, hey, does anybody know the prosecutor? That wasn't asked. I think that that's ineffective assistance. I think any attorney, any trial attorney, if they know of a relationship where a juror, eventually the foreman, is going to be spending an hour a week with the attorney on the other side, that's a no-brainer. You're going to get rid of him.
There was a question, wasn't there, about whether or not he could be fair and impartial in this case?
Yes. The court asked a generalized question. Can you be fair and impartial? Nothing in specific of, hey, because of this relationship, is there anything about this relationship that would make you tend to believe the prosecutor's arguments or the prosecution's witnesses more so than any defense argument or defense witnesses? There was never any specified line of questioning in that.
Following up on Judge Inbody's question regarding Zomke and the affidavit, and then the discussion on the lack of alleging facts, what facts did you allege in regard to that assignment?
Well, I thought that I had alleged Lomke would have found there was deficits in adaptive behaviors had he been allowed to perform the testing that he wanted, that the state's witness, the state's expert, wanted to perform. He was prohibited from performing those tests by trial counsel. And I think that's ineffective. At that point, you've got it. Whether you've got it or you don't, let the test come in and let the test show so you can either pursue that argument or abandon that argument. And I think trial counsel interfered with the ability of the state's expert to perform the tests that would have shown deficits in adaptive behavior. That would have been the second prong, and that would have precluded a death penalty.
Finally, although I suppose the opposite argument would be made had Zlomke done the test and found no deficits in adaptive behavior,
sure,
then you'd have a different argument.
Sure, but I think based on his testing that he wanted to do and based on his affidavit saying my tests were incomplete, it was disturbing that I think that the court based a lot of its decision on Zlomke's testimony, which differed from what his affidavit said. And I think if he had testified as his affidavit in saying, hey, my tests weren't complete, I don't think then you can draw any conclusions in the negative or saying, yeah, there's adaptive, he's fine with adaptive behavior. He would have been the opposite.
Thank you. And that concludes the arguments for today, and the parties are excused, and we are adjourned.